Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On June 15, 2020, by a vote of 6-3, the Supreme Court released its decision in Bostock v. Clayton County, a case combined with Altitude Inc. v. Zarda and R.G. and G.R. Harris Funeral Homes Incorporated. The Supreme Court reversed and remanded the case to the 11th Circuit. The majority opinion, written by Justice Gorsuch, was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Alito dissented, joined by Justices Thomas and Kavanaugh. And now, to discuss the case, we have Kurt Levy, President of the Committee for Justice.
Now, I think, you know, a decade or two ago, probably most of the debate would have been about, you know, the very notion of such rights, you know, should gay and transgender people have rights? I think, you know, by 2020, most Americans agree that, you know, discrimination against LGBT folks is wrong. And in fact, most people I talk to seem to think it's already banned by federal law. They're surprised to hear Title VII doesn't cover it. Now, that's not to say that there are no complications like religious liberty issues, but I think most people support the general proposition. And, you know, even the dissenters acknowledged, you know, that there is good policy reasons for wanting to expand Title VII. I believe Kavanaugh said that, you know, the policy arguments were very weighty, and Alito, you know, mentioned, you know, that it's painful to be reminded of the way that our society once treated gays and lesbians, you know, just certainly within the last several decades. So instead of, you know, focusing on whether there should be such rights, the debate is really focused on whether courts are the proper branch for expanding Title VII. As Justice Kavanaugh put it in dissent, this case boils down to one fundamental question: who decides? And his answer was that, you know, the responsibility to amend Title VII belongs to Congress and the president and not the Supreme Court or any court. And I agree with him, but Gorsuch, in his majority opinion, saw it differently. He said he wasn't doing anything like amending Title VII. He was doing nothing more than interpreting the text of Title VII. And he does focus on textual analysis, but his analysis is strained. The opinion, you know, might be easy to dismiss, you know, as just another example of politics masquerading as interpretation. If it had been written by one of the court's liberal justices, or, you know, even I think by Chief Justice Roberts, but it deserves to be taken more seriously because Gorsuch is, you know, a principled textualist. I mean, he's been consistent about that since he's been on the court. And again, Gorsuch does rely on, you know, detailed textual arguments, you know, which conservatives should at least be happy with that. You know, under Kennedy probably would have written the opinion a few years ago, and we would have gotten something, you know, about the right to define one's own concept of existence. For those not lawyers or old enough to remember, that was the wording in the 92 Casey decision that affirmed Roe v. Wade. But, you know, Kennedy has used language like that since, and like I say, probably would have again. Now, the case hinges on Title VII's command that it's unlawful for an employer to discriminate against any individual because of the individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Now, note, sexual orientation and identity are not on that list. But Gorsuch reasons that discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity is really discrimination based on sex, because the example he gives is, you know, if a gay man is fired because he's gay, he's fired because he's attracted to men, even though a similarly situated woman would not be fired for being attracted to men. But that's a stretch, as Alito points out in dissent, because the employer's real objection is not, you know, that he's attracted to men. It's the homosexual orientation. He would in all likelihood, be equally upset about prejudiced towards a woman who is attracted to women. And Alito, I think, very well refutes, Gorsuch's argument by pointing out that you could have an employer who, didn't ask the biological or any type of sex of job applicants, but did ask whether they were, homosexual or transgender and refused to hire them if they were. And that would be discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. But it couldn't be discrimination based on sex because the employer wouldn't even know their sex. You know, as Kavanaugh said in dissent, really anyone familiar with the use of the English language understands that the ordinary meaning, which is what we look at when we're talking about textual analysis, the ordinary meaning of sexual orientation or gender identity discrimination is different and distinct from the ordinary meaning of sex discrimination. I mean, federal law distinguishes the two. States that do ban sexual orientation discrimination explicitly distinguish the two. The court in its cases have distinguished the two. The advocacy groups that, have pushed for the expansion of Title VII distinguish the two. So, Gorsuch's reading of the text is not completely indefensible, but it's certainly not the most natural one. And, Kavanaugh in his dissent quotes Scalia, quoting Leonard Hand, that a sterile literalism, or one could substitute textualism, loses sight of the forest for the trees. And I think that's sort of what's going on here. You can maybe say that Gorsuch's reading of the text is correct or plausible in some very technical sense, but it really loses sight of the forest for the trees. But even if we were to give Gorsuch the benefit of the doubt and say that his reading is as plausible as the alternative, he runs into the problem that his interpretation is completely at odds with the legislative intent. Not even the plaintiffs in this case claim that anyone in Congress in 1964, when Title VII was enacted, intended the text to mean what Gorsuch says it means. Now, Gorsuch is correct that legislative history should never defeat unambiguous statutory text, but his claim that no ambiguity exists and that the answer here is clear, really strains credulity. I mean, it certainly wasn't clear to the lower courts until just a few years ago. Every single court of appeals, 10 different panels, I believe, so that's 30 different judges, saw it the other way. So, not only is it not clear, but, it wasn't even close. I mean, Gorsuch's interpretation had a record of zero wins and 30 losses. Were the text as clear as Gorsuch imagines it to be, all the bills introduced in Congress over the last 45 years to protect gay and more recently transgender Americans from employment discrimination would have been redundant. But, the advocates for those bills, and I remember them testifying in front of Congress, including civil rights officials from the Obama administration, they all recognized that Title VII needed amending to protect against LGBT discrimination. And, protecting against that discrimination is a noble goal, but the separation of powers and generally democratic principles instruct us that, the job of amending Title VII to do that belongs to the elected branches, not the courts. Alito said that in a more fired up way. Let me see the quote here. It said, there's only one word for what the court has done today, legislation. Now, public opinion on gay and transgender rights are rapidly evolving. Congress would likely have extended Title VII to LGBT discrimination in the near future. And, it would have had the imprimatur of wide public support. But instead, now the expansion of Title IX, has the taint that comes from being imposed by unelected judges. So, really would have been better for all concerned to have gone the legislative route, and that requires a little bit of patience, but that's true of all legislation. Moreover, courts are not equipped to engage in the complex policy compromises that are necessary when expanding something like Title VII. Instead, we get a binary decision, which in this case left difficult questions about, for example, whether sex-segregated bathrooms and locker rooms would be legal in the workplace, the degree to which, there can be accommodation of employers' religious convictions. And it may even spill over to Title IX, which which bans sex discrimination in educational institutions. For example, it could, you know, make it a lot easier for, you know, men to play on and perhaps displace women on women's teams. I just saw an article just a few hours ago in a higher education publication, you know, that said that, you know, yesterday's decision could transform Title IX. Now, Gorsuch said these are all questions for future cases, you know, not the cases that before the court. And yeah, it's put off for now. But, you know, these questions are sure to cause divisive battles precisely because they haven't been addressed in a thoughtful or really any way, as they would have been had this been done legislatively. So I know a lot of conservatives are disappointed with Gorsuch after tomorrow. I guess, you know, question is, should we be? Well, we certainly shouldn't be because, you know, we don't like the outcome for those who don't like the outcome. You know, let's leave the outcome-oriented, you know, judging of Supreme Court opinions to progressives. They're good at that. You know, in fact, I think Gorsuch's opinion is really a dramatic illustration that conservative judicial principles like textualism are not just, you know, an excuse, a cover for outcome-oriented judging, as, you know, liberal legal academics, you know, always like to claim they are. Sometimes they lead to results that the judge using them would not have wanted if it, you know, been up to him. You know, that being said, you can be principled and wrong. Those aren't mutually exclusive. And, you know, in this case, I think, you know, Gorsuch is probably wrong. I think the dissents have the better argument here. You know, finally, I don't think we should let the focus on Gorsuch, you know, following the decision, obscure the fact that Roberts once again sided with the courts for liberals. And, you know, he's making a habit of that. I mean, he did it on the census citizenship question, the New York gun case, our deference to the administrative state. Those are the most prominent examples over the last 12 months. So, you know, if he wasn't already, he's now firmly established as a moderate swing vote that's, you know, really up for grabs.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.